Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Student Loan Planner podcast. This is Angie Pack, and I'm here with Ben Lacomas, and we're going to chat with you today about the pay-as-you-earn plan. It is going away July 1st, 2024. So Ben, I guess just to kick us off, tell me about what is going on with pay-as-you-earn.
Yeah, thanks, Angie. Excited to be a co-host with you for the podcast. As always, it feels like we're half student loan consultants, half in charge of discussing the weather with all of its changes. But student loans and weather tend to do that. This big change coming up this time is indeed a little bit of a storm, but only for some people. So the pay-as-you-earn income-driven repayment plan has been around since the Obama administration, and it is one of the more advantageous income-driven repayment plans out there. That plan, one other, and then a few not as major changes, but still some big ones, are going to be the focus of what we're covering today. And pay is going away. That's the biggest part of the deal. That's the summary.
I've noticed, Ben, that we talk a lot about pay going away at Student Loan Planner, but there hasn't been a whole lot of news or any other media coverage of pay going away. And could you just let us know why that is? I'm super curious.
Yeah, I can definitely conjecture to some pieces. I feel like fairly strong conjecture is that one of the reasons for pay going away and even the implementation of SAVE is that our job security even is a double-edged sword. Like, student loans should not need to be this complex, and they've been complex for at least 30 years now with the advent of income-driven repayment plans. And there's so many acronyms and there's so many options that I think the move was just to eliminate complexity by removing some options and to hopefully make it better for borrowers in that regard, that the decision-making to go into what's best to do with your student loans, how to repay them, how to pursue forgiveness, et cetera, is a bit more simplified. You know, ideally taking some burden off of Department of Education and loan servicers to make it more simple for borrowers, but also to take a load off the borrower's shoulders too. And usually for major changes like SAVE, the department's really taking a priority or a big stance to communicate better, because there hasn't necessarily been the greatest track record with changes in student loans or student loan programs being thoroughly communicated for borrowers to act on. And, you know, if we think of the advent of the new SAVE plan relative to what's going on with pay now, it's talked about a lot more because I think it can help a lot more borrowers, and they're trying to simplify the system of pushing more people into SAVE, but it's not right for everybody. And pay is right for a lot of people, especially a lot of people who would be potentially listening to this podcast episode today, because pay has a shorter time length to reach forgiveness through income-driven repayment plans when you're not doing public service loan forgiveness. It's not being talked about, maybe because they just want to keep things simple and they've got the exciting SAVE plan and enough of other stuff that's going on. But when they finished SAVE, it was spelled out in the regulations that they were going to, quote unquote, limit student borrowers to new enrollment in repay, now SAVE, and to IBR or income-based repayment, but that pay is going away come July 1st, 2024, if you're not already enrolled. So it's in the register, which is a massive legal document that goes over these changes that occurred through negotiated rulemaking. And it's in there, but you're right. Loan servicers aren't telling us. It's not on studentaid.gov, as far as I'm aware, or as of the date of this podcast, at least we haven't seen a darn thing. And some borrowers have even told us that they've asked their loan servicer, is pay going away? And they've asked the chat representatives through studentaid.gov, is pay going away? And they'll get back, per usual, mixed responses, or maybe even just no's. or sorry, I'm not familiar with that, let me circle back, even when the borrower provides them the exact writing of the Federal Register that says it's going away. So I do think it's not being communicated a little bit on purpose, like tactfully, but it's also not the greatest thing because it is a really big change.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much. You know, I would have absolutely thought that it would have been published on studentaid.gov. And you were actually one, Ben, who told me that it wasn't. And I couldn't believe it. And I went and I searched on studentaid.gov for the announcement. And sure enough, it wasn't there. But you and I have both seen with our own eyes that it is in the Federal Register. And this is something that's happening. So pay is going away. So for our listeners, I think the big question is, should we be on pay? And how do we know if we should be on pay? What are the advantages of being on pay versus a plan like SAVE? We've heard a lot communicated in the media about the SAVE plan, which replaced Repay last summer. But this is kind of a last minute Hail Mary opportunity for a lot of folks, depending on borrowing dates. So maybe let's just kind of dig in. Like, who does this impact? Who are the people who would be eligible for pay? And what's kind of at stake here with pay going away and the deadline being July 1st, 2024, needing to be on it by July 1st, 2024? Yeah. So what's at stake here?
Great questions. And I think great direction for us. So it'll be fun to come up with some examples and make sure you tell me rein it in, Ben, if I get too deep into any weeds, as can happen with these things. And one of those weeds or one of those details that we need to address is how to figure out if you qualify for pay. And then we'll talk about how to start figuring out if you know if it's best for you. But how to qualify for it, first, you have to have the right types of loans. And obviously, we're talking about federal student loans in general, but you need to have direct loans, not family federal education loans. If you're listening to this within a month of it being released or before July, we still also have the IDR account adjustment or waiver going on right now, where if you do have FFEL, Family Federal Education, older federal loans that you could consolidate, they would then be direct loans and you wouldn't lose any of your repayment history. So the first thing is loan type. And if you don't have direct loans, you should consider consolidation during this IDR waiver such that you can get direct loans, but that's not it. There's also the new borrower definition that can lead to a restriction from entering the plan, and there is the partial financial hardship definition, which could mean restriction from the plan as well. In terms of borrower dates, pay as you earn is the date restriction on the front end, October 1st, 2007, and then one that has to be dispersed after, I believe, October 2010. For that first loan, it's written out, as I just said it, on the studentaid.gov site, but there is a little bit more of a nuance to it, and that is if you did borrow any loans before October 1st, 2007, which would normally mean you can't use pay, if you did borrow any, you can still use pay. As long as you paid off all of those loans borrowed before October 1st, 2007 in full before borrowing again after. So they kind of define new borrower as of when you got loans after that date, if you had a balance at that time or not. So if you have any loans that had balances prior to October 1st, 2007 that still had balances when you borrowed thereafter, you are excluded from pay and you cannot use it. But if all of your loans are brand new, or if you fit that other nuanced definition as of October 1st, 2007, and you have direct loans, then pay is an option for you as long as you don't make too much money relative to your loan balance, which in student loan fancy pants terms, they call the partial financial hardship requirement for pay, which is also relevant to the income-based repayment plan, or IBR, and the partial financial hardship requirement says that your would-be payment in the pay plan at the time of application cannot surpass what a standard 10-year repayment plan would be for you. And if you violate the partial financial hardship, meaning payment would be too high relative to the standard 10-year, then you're not allowed in that plan either. So recapping, right type of loan, right dates of loans, and not violating the partial financial hardship, which essentially functions as that cap in pay as you earn that some of you may be aware of and that we're going to talk about with a few examples.
Awesome. And really the concern, and there are many concerns about why you'd want to be on pay as you earn potentially. And one of which is that pay as you earn will give these borrowers who borrowed between 2007 and 2014 the opportunity to get on a 20-year timeline to forgiveness they wouldn't otherwise have access to. So anybody who borrowed after July 1st, 2014 has access to new income-based repayment. And that would give any borrowers in that camp, if that's you, the question about whether or not to get on pay is a non-issue because you'll have access to this new IBR plan that will give you the 20-year timeline to forgiveness. It effectively functions just like the pay-as-you-earn plan. But the critical population listening to this podcast, wondering if they need to act, would be those particular borrowers who've met the criteria that you just outlined, Ben, but are wanting to get on a 20-year timeline to forgiveness track, or just aren't sure if actually a 20-year timeline to forgiveness track might benefit them. And that's really the kind of the question that we're hoping to flesh out for our audience today is just, if you are one of these borrowers who borrowed between 2007 and 2014, you may or may not benefit from a 20-year timeline, but this is your kind of your last chance to get that 20-year timeline on your graduate school loans only. So on the SAVE plan, your undergraduate loans are eligible for forgiveness on an income-driven plan on SAVE after 20 years of payments, but grad loans on SAVE are forgiven after 25. So anybody who borrowed in kind of that critical window, October 1st, 2007 through June 30th, 2014, this podcast episode really is for you. We're going to go through and we're going to talk about what are the thoughts that you would need to consider if whether or not, if you're not on pay as you earn right now, maybe you're on SAVE, if you want to switch over to pay prior to the deadline.
Very well said. If one can qualify for the newer version of income-based repayment or income-based repayment for new borrowers, meaning you meet the new borrower definition I described earlier, but move to July 1st, 2014, then this is non-issue for you that pay is going away. You have a decision you can make down the road, technically before July 1st, 2029, which we'll get into that reason a bit later as to if it makes sense to switch into new IBR. So if pay doesn't sound relevant to you at this point, not necessarily the only helpful stuff for you we're potentially going to be covering today. We also have the income contingent repayment plan going away and a few other changes come July 1st for federal student loans and income-driven repayment plans that were part of the SAVE regulations that will go into effect, including the weighted average when you consolidate the weighted average of credit for forgiveness, whether it's public service loan forgiveness or these 20 or 25-year forgiveness programs, used to be a complete reset or with the waiver more favorable. And this is a bit of an in-between. That piece starts, and as well as some other forbearance periods we'll very briefly cover, those will now count as time in repayment, similar to how they did under the waiver. I think, Angie, you really hit the major pieces too there with why pay for some relative to SAVE being right for a lot of people. And it's, I think, fairly misunderstood out there, maybe not necessarily by our listeners, but well, maybe by everyone, that loans are forgiven and SAVE under 20 years and not 25 when you're not doing public service loan forgiveness and if you're pursuing forgiveness through an income-driven repayment plan. And the regulations make it pretty clear that it's 25 years, just like repay was, if you've borrowed any graduate loans. Even if you kill off those loans and only have undergrad left, or it doesn't forgive the undergrad one sooner, if you borrowed for graduate loans, you're now on a 25-year clock instead of a 20-year clock. I think we each are going to create a little example here and talk about them, but think about anyone out there who's got a high balance and a high income, or an income that's high or good, but it's not as high as your student loan balance, or it's not significantly greater than that. But if you have a pretty high income, let's say $200,000 and a loan balance of $400,000, we're talking about 5 years of payments in an income-driven repayment plan, paying somewhere to the tune of $2,000 a month, or if your income's going to be even higher before you reach forgiveness, maybe more. But this is the chance to pay five less years of a significant number if forgiveness is what makes sense for you for the long term. So very big deal for a lot of doctors, dentists, attorneys, veterinarians, chiropractors, really anyone who took out a significant federal student loan balance and isn't out earning it. Do you want to lead off the examples, Angie, or should I, or is there anything else you think we should cover before hitting those?
I would say that maybe before jumping into the examples, let's kind of do a little overview of the SAVE plan and why somebody who's on the SAVE plan might want to consider switching over to the PAY plan. So just maybe going through the nuances of the differences of the plans. So with the SAVE plan, it replaced Repay last summer, created by the Biden administration. And some of the key features are that for undergraduate loans, instead of paying 10% of net discretionary income, you would pay 5%. So SAVE Overpay does have a savings on the payment. And even if you have 100% grad loans, 100% grad loans on SAVE and PAY are all calculated at 10% of net discretionary income. But where SAVE has a slight edge over Overpay would be on the federal poverty line deduction. So the federal poverty line deduction is subtracted from your adjusted gross income to arrive at what your annual student loan payment is. On average, I'd say the payment ends up being about somewhere between $100 and $150 a month on average, lower on SAVE than on PAY. But as you mentioned, that shortened timeline to forgiveness of 20 years, oftentimes shaving off those last 5 years, the last 60 payments, when your income is increasing, can actually give the edge over to PAY in many cases. Another thing that you would want to be considering as well is if you have a lower income relative to your debt balance, sometimes the key feature of the SAVE plan is, or one of the key features is the unpaid interest subsidy. So that unpaid interest subsidy, if you have that lower income relative to your loan balance, can really help keep the interest accrual in check, because any amount that your monthly payment is not covering on the interest. So let's say that your monthly payment is $500 a month, but every month you have $1,000 a month that's accruing in interest. $500 of that is going to be subsidized on the SAVE plan, not so on PAY. So on PAY, you're going to pay your $500 payment, let's say, or maybe it's a $600 payment. And the $400 that represents that unpaid interest is actually being added to your principal balance. So if you're getting forgiveness at the end of that 20-year term, you may have a very, very large tax bomb because your forgiven balance is going to be higher than it would have been on SAVE. So that's another nuance that borrowers have to consider is how much am I benefiting from this unpaid interest subsidy on SAVE? And does that unpaid interest subsidy outweigh the extra payments that I'm going to be making on SAVE if I'm having to pay a larger tax liability once that balance is forgiven after the term, 20 years on PAY or 25 years on SAVE? So it's another key distinction between SAVE and PAY, and another nuance that you have to consider when weighing whether or not you want to get on PAY instead of SAVE or SAVE instead of PAY. Yeah, anything you want to fill in there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well put. And I think some of those features are really exciting for a lot of people too. The unpaid interest subsidy can be obviously or tangibly beneficial when you know you're going to pay your loans off in full and not pursue forgiveness anyways. If you know you're going to be a high earning private practice physician or dentist and you have a high loan balance, but your income's ultimately going to overtake that in the first 5 to 10 years of repayment, maybe pursuing long-term taxable forgiveness doesn't make sense to you. But when you're in training years, you can have a $0 to $200 to $300 a month payment and have potentially thousands of dollars a month or year, depending on your loan balance, subsidized. And that's very real dollars that you don't have to pay off later. It becomes more complicated for us even as consultants when helping people figure out what's best to do, how to weigh something like that unpaid interest subsidy against something like getting forgiveness sooner. Because another one of those things that we've had a few updates over the years on is we call long-term forgiveness taxable forgiveness, because outside of the temporary pause on taxable forgiveness right now, it is generally to be treated as earned income. And if you're going to have a higher balance in pay at the time of forgiveness because you don't have an interest subsidy and because you've paid for less years, maybe that tax bomb is a bit higher. But if the tax bomb is tax-free again, then it's almost like that unpaid interest subsidy from SAVE sounded like a cherry on top, but it was really just a mirage cherry. It was no real benefit, whereas being done 5 years sooner could be very real regardless of what happens with tax changes. So SAVE's awesome if you're paying your balance off or if eventually at some point anyways and you can get the subsidy, or if you're pursuing forgiveness and we don't know what's going to happen with the tax bomb, obviously, but having less interest means owing less tax on the back end too.
Well, let's kind of go through a couple of different examples of borrowers who could benefit from the SAVE plan. I guess I'll go ahead and begin and I'll share an example of a physician. So both Ben and I are student loan planner consultants, but we also work as financial planners with SLP Wealth. I work with a physician team. Ben does as well. But Ben's going to share an example of a dentist and I'm going to be sharing an example of a physician. So something that's common for our physician clients is that they may or may not have taken out loans for undergrad, but our clients who are, you know, seeking us out for either financial planning advice or for student loan advice took out loans for medical school. That's primarily what they're coming to us for, is like, how do I tackle this $250,000 debt from medical school? And what's interesting for physicians specifically is that their income starts out quite low relative to what their income is going to be when they become an attending. So while you're in residency or a fellowship, your income tends to be substantially less. So let's take the example of a physician who's a resident, and maybe they're earning $75,000 or $80,000 per year. So they've got this low income right now, and maybe their payment, say, on the SAVE plan is something along the lines of $137 per month. If you're making $75,000 per year, you're married, maybe you've got one dependent, somewhere in that ballpark of $100 to $150 per month on the SAVE plan. Now, if they were to switch over to the pay plan, their payment would jump up a bit, closer to $300 a month. While they're in training, their payment is going to be low. And so that unpaid interest is going to be accruing on the pay-as-you-earn plan. However, let's say that this physician graduates, finishes training, maybe they go to fellowship for a year. So let's just say, like, for the sake of like doing a pure pay-as-you-earn borrower, let's say that this borrower went to undergrad from, let's say, 2010 to 2014. They went to undergrad. Maybe they took a couple years off and then they went to medical school. So they went to medical school from 2016 to 2020, graduated from medical school, then went to residency from 2020 to 2023, and then had a one-year fellowship. So while they're in residency, their payment would be based on that $75,000 of income. And let's say that they're finishing fellowship this year. They're finishing their fellowship in 2024, and now they are going into the workforce. their 2024 income is going to be half of their residence or half of their fellowship salary. So let's say 75,000 plus half of their attending salary, which is going to be 250,000 to start. So as their payments jump, and let's just say that they're getting 3% raises per year, their first year as an attending, full year as an attending, their payment jumps to, let's say, $1,600 a month on the SAVE plan. And on the pay-as-you-earn plan, let's say it's $1,800 a month. Over time, you are going to be paying more on the pay-as-you-earn plan. But towards the end of those last 60 payments, once you hit that 20 years under pay, so you're done, right? You're done after 20 years on pay-as-you-earn. Your final payment, let's say, is $2,650. On the SAVE plan, yes, maybe your payment is $2,400 or $2,450, somewhere in that range. But as your income continues to increase, you've got $2,500 per month payments for another 5 years. So over the course of that repayment, even with the unpaid interest subsidy and even with a tax bomb, the borrower who's finishing on pay-as-you-earn and is shaving those last 5 years off, they're going to pay probably about $35,000 more in taxes in the year of forgiveness on the pay plan, but they're going to be saving about $80,000 on the total cost of loan payback. So they'll have paid on pay-as-you-earn about $390,000 of payments. But on SAVE, they're paying over $500,000. So once you kind of net out the taxes, the extra taxes that you pay on SAVE with the extra payments that you'd be making on the SAVE plan, you end up coming out ahead on pay by about $80,000. So for this particular borrower who, you know, is shaving off those last 5 years, you actually are better off on pay even without having the unpaid interest subsidy. And you see this, the benefit of being on pay increase even more for borrowers who have rapidly increasing incomes and who can benefit from a payment cap. So let's say that this first example that I gave is a primary care physician who's starting out at $250,000. But instead, let's swap it out with maybe, let's say, a surgeon who's starting out at $500,000. As this borrower transitions from fellowship into attending salary, they may now cross over the threshold if they are on SAVE, where they're going to have a payment that exceeds what their standard 10-year amount would be. SAVE does not have a payment cap. And this can be critical for our borrowers who are starting out at lower salaries and who expect that they're going to have really rapidly increasing income or a big income jump. Being on pay for this borrower would cap out their payment at their standard 10-year amount. When on SAVE, it could go up as high as $8,000-$9,000 per month if you're making enough money. So that's another kind of, I would say, flag to kind of think, like, if that's you, definitely consider getting on pay-as-you-earn. How about a dentist, Ben?
Well, honestly, I think we could kill two birds with one stone. I may just piggyback off of your example a bit instead, because I think covering that from the context you did with 20 versus 25-year forgiveness, I think that speaks really well to a lot of similar times it would apply to someone in dental medicine or veterinarian. I think the other piece of your example there that we could just turn into two is, yeah, that payment cap. And how is that used? In your case, you know, maybe that income comes towards the end and they're just trying to make it still be more efficient for forgiveness. So having a lower payment in pay relative to SAVE at that point would be good. The other time we see it come into play is if you're PSLF, public service loan forgiveness eligible, where maybe 5 or 6 years in training, and then maybe you're going to be earning significantly more than your balance at a PSLF eligible hospital or any career, but still piggybacking off of medicine. If that's the case, then instead of having a really high payment in SAVE, you can get your last 2, 3, 4 years of PSLF credit using pay, because that partial financial hardship or that cap or that equivalent to a standard 10-year payment it's restrictive to get into the plan, but it's a huge savior when you're already in the plan. And it's like a protective ceiling rather than a restrictive ceiling at that point. Now, as long as someone has consolidated their loans at any point, they're going to have to use something like Pay or like Save or an income-driven repayment plan for PSLF. If you've never consolidated, you can technically use the standard 10-year payment without the cap anyways, regardless of which plan you're using. So maybe in that case, someone could hang out and save and then swap to a standard 10-year payment plan as long as they've never consolidated. But if you've consolidated and your income's going to go up a good bit relative to your balance and you're pursuing PSLF, then you need to get on Pay before it closes so you can have that cap for the last few years of payments if it's going to mean more than paying an additional $100, $150 a month in Save between now and then. So I think those are two really strong, like, numbers oriented cases that would speak to one using Pay for 20-year forgiveness or Pay for the cap, whether for 20-year forgiveness or for PSLF. For folks who borrowed all of their loans after 2014, this decision right now isn't as critical because the other rule that comes into effect July 1st, 2024, related to these plans and related to the Save plan, is that starting July 1st, 2024, once you've made 5 years of payments in Save, you cannot use another income-driven repayment plan. But if you switch prior to that 60-month or 5-year payment threshold starting July 2024, then if you have all new loans as of July 1st, 2014, you can switch into the new income-based repayment plan, new IBR, and still have that 20-year taxable forgiveness time period, still have the same payment cap. And it's kind of the be in Save, but know you're swapping to IBR strategy that exists for the newest borrowers. But those two examples were perfect for that subset of borrowers we described earlier that qualifies for Pay and Save, but not for the new version of income-based repayment, only the old version of income-based repayment. So Pay is going away. This 5-year clock is starting. And then small example here, because I don't think it's going to be relevant to a lot of our listeners, but is for the income contingent repayment or ICR plan going away. ICR is the income driven repayment plan that's been around since 1994. We're coming up on the 30-year anniversary when they're killing it off. And it's largely good for Parent Plus borrowers who can't do the double Parent Plus consolidation loophole, but it has also been relevant. It'll still be available for those Parent Plus borrowers, but it's still, in some cases, relevant for similar situations to what we just described, where a payment cap is necessary. Maybe you have really high income relative to your balance, and you need a few more years for PSLF or for taxable forgiveness, and the payment and Save would be just simply too high. Maybe your income's 100, 200, 300, 400,000, and your loan balance is 20, 30, 40, 50 grand, the payment and Save would be huge because there's no cap in it. And you've already violated the partial financial hardship requirements of Pay and IBR. In these cases, this is where the ICR plan was nice to have as a backup option because ICR has a different cap in it that's not as favorable as Pay and IBR's, but it's not as restrictive either. And even if you were making $1 million a year and had a loan balance of 20,000, you could get a cap in ICR if you just needed to use it for 2 or 3 years, but no longer. So maybe if that describes one of you listeners, don't hesitate to reach out. We can help you figure out how the heck the cap in ICR works. But ICR and Pay both going away if you're not already in them as of July 1st, 2024, unless you're a Parent Plus borrower who's consolidated, who's looking to use the ICR plan, and isn't doing the double Parent Plus consolidation loophole before that closes July 1st of next year, 2025.
I'm so glad that you brought up ICR, Ben, because I actually have had a couple of clients that I met with who did qualify for ICR, and where that actually was the most strategic move for them was to get on income contingent repayment. And so I would say that if you're wondering if you are one of these borrowers, I tend to see this with clients who've been paying on their loans for a long time. So that would be criteria number one. So if you suspect, maybe you took out your loans kind of in the mid 2000s, you've been making payments for 20 plus years. I mean, 22 years, let's say, somewhere like 22 plus years. Your balance relative to your income is low. So let's say you've got $40,000 left on all of your loans, and maybe you're well established in your career, a lawyer, maybe your MBA, maybe you've been a surgeon for a while, and your income's high. So let's say you make $400,000 a year, $500,000 a year, but you've got this small loan balance. Ordinarily, on any other plan, you wouldn't be able to qualify for the pay plans, the 20-year forgiveness. If you were to get on the save plan, your payment would be astronomical. I mean, multiple thousands per month. So you just pay off those $40,000. Let's say your payment's $4,000 a month. You're going to pay off those $40,000 of loans in 10 months. But if you are this borrower, right? So sure, you're close to that 25-year forgiveness timeline that you would qualify for on IBR or save. You could actually get on income contingent repayment, which is going to cap your payment at what it would be calculated as though you were paying over a 12-year term. So if you've got a $40,000 loan, paying on that over a 12-year term is actually not going to be, it's going to be in the three figures most likely. Definitely more affordable than that $4,000 or $5,000 a month payment. And in many cases, you actually do end up with a forgiven balance if you're close enough to forgiveness. So let's say, you've been paying for 22 to 23 years and you've got maybe 2 or 3 years left. So that would be a case under which you'd want to get on ICR. So if that's you, maybe you've got FFEL loans, old FFEL loans. Maybe you do have direct loans, but you've been paying since like the late 2000s, so 2008, 2009 on your loans, or mid 2000s. That might be worth exploring for you, because you may have thought like, I'm just going to have to pay off these loans completely in full. No, not so fast. You could actually potentially qualify for forgiveness under income contingent repayment.
Yeah, definitely the weirdest plan out there. The cap is not restrictive. It's that standard 12-year payment multiplied by a factor only available and republished annually in the Federal Register. So you have to Google search Federal Register income contingent repayment, scroll down to the table, and you'll see if you're making a couple hundred grand, 350, 410 single, you multiply that 12-year payment by two. If you're making less than that, it's all a lower factor, even as low down to basically half of what the 12-year payment is. So obscure plan, but I think that's a great example. Or if you're really out earning your balance and really close to PSLF, you need to look at the ICR plan before that goes away. I think we should probably close, and you tell me otherwise. You've been an excellent driving today's podcast for everybody, but I think you should talk people through what you're seeing on the consultant and ground forces front lines. That's what I'm looking for, of any potential issues people are running into taking these last minute / last month decisions to make sure they're in the right place. I've heard mention of some issues with getting into pay with the online applications. And I don't think issues surprise us, because as we just surmised, pay is going away, ICR is going away, weighted average rules for forgiveness count and consolidation is coming into play, and then a small handful of different forbearance statuses or deferments are now going to count towards forgiveness as well, starting this July. So there's a lot happening in the next month, and there's already been a lot happening for the last month, many months.
Yeah, July 1st, 2024 is going to be a big day. Because then also that, the IDR waiver, as you mentioned earlier, is also the expiration is June 30th. So June 30th is a big deadline for ICR, for pay as you earn, for the IDR account adjustment, if you're going to consolidate and take advantage of that. One thing that we actually didn't mention yet, Ben, as to why people may want to consider getting on pay, even if actually the numbers would go in favor of the SAVE plan, is the political uncertainty surrounding the SAVE plan. So even if on paper, the SAVE looks like you are going to pay the least out of pocket over your 25-year term, not so fast, right? Because there has been a lot, and Travis has covered this extensively in his newsletter and on previous podcast episodes, but we just don't really know what's going to happen with SAVE after the election, depending on which way it goes, right? So SAVE was created by the Biden administration. It's something I believe that Biden wants to have as a part of his legacy. It's his baby. And so we're all at Student Loan Planner pretty confident that if Biden wins the election, that the SAVE plan is going to stick around. But there are some folks who do qualify. Maybe they're on the SAVE plan right now. They qualify for pay and they're wondering, ooh, what do I do if maybe Trump wins the election and the SAVE plan goes away and I could have been on pay, but now I don't have access to it because July 1st, 2024 passed. So what would I do in that scenario? And we actually have a fun little cash phrase for that. We call it pay to save. So pay to save could be a strategy if you are worried about political risk. So if you're worried about how the election might go, if pay could be repealed, if Trump were to be elected, it could be a form of income-driven repayment insurance, right? To get on pay now, see what happens in November. And then maybe, you know, the day after the election and that first week of November, the first Tuesday in November, you see that Biden wins, you just switch right back on over to SAFE. But if Trump wins, then, you know, maybe you hang tight on pay for a little bit just to kind of see how things are going to shake out because we don't know. So that might be something worth considering too. Just if you wanted to be, you know, have the certainty that you're going to be locked into a plan that's pretty good, maybe not quite as good as SAVE, but pretty dang good with a 20-year timeline to forgiveness and a payment cap, pay might be a good option just to have as a contingency plan.
Yeah, I really wish it was more clear. I think striding towards giving borrowers more clear options is a nice goal, but I'd really like to see it not always feel so tiptoey when you're making big decisions like these with loans and when you could see any reality happening. I mean, repay, for example, is now just SAVE. There's no option for the few people that it made sense to stay in repay to stay in repay. But in that rules we've been referencing, kept in the Federal Register for the SAVE regs, they say that they're not forcing any borrowers to switch from a plan they're currently using and that they don't believe that that is appropriate for pay. They just did it for repay, but repay became SAVE. Pay isn't becoming anything except maybe kind of this ghost income-driven repayment plan that Angie is 1,000% right on. Who's going to touch it? It's going to become like a forgotten plan. So it's almost a form of ensuring the level of options you have by making sure that pay is available to you should something change with SAVE that doesn't grant you a similar protection to them thinking it's not appropriate to end your ability to use it. So truly could go either way, but we do know pay is really going to become this forgotten or ghost IDR plan that some people are in, but no new enrollees can get into it after this July.
Right. You know, it's pretty secure, right? As much as we can hope in the student loan universe, whereas is SAVE, not so much. It was created. It did not go through the normal legislative process. Therefore, it can be repealed pretty easily as well. Whereas pay, it's a plan that they're phasing out. They're letting whoever's currently qualified for it to get on it and should be able to stay on it. That's kind of how they are phasing out this plan. Yep, just kind of depending on how you feel about political risk, PayPan might be a good temporary stopgap measure for you, even if SAVE ends up being the best plan in the long term. Just kind of can hang out on pay since you have that as an option, see how things go, and then maybe consider switching after that. Ben, you did mention that there have been some snafus for our borrowers getting on to the pay plan. And so I did want to kind of talk through that and what we're seeing on the student loan planner side with our consultations and our clients and kind of give you a little bit of guidance as to how to make sure that you're able to get on the pay plan as quickly as possible. So we don't know. The fact of the matter is we don't know if the deadline for getting on pay is that you submit that application by June 30th, or if you have to actually be enrolled in pay by June 30th. So my line is like, let's not take any chances. Let's get on pay. If you want to be on pay, let's get on it as soon as possible. So here's how to do that. Number one, if you're consolidating, you can apply for an income-driven plan in your consolidation application and you can select pay. If you also elect to have the Department of Ed pull through your tax data from the IRS. So when you go to enroll in an income-driven plan, whether you're consolidating or not, they give you the option to link your IRS data with the Department of Ed. It saves you from having to recertify your income every year. But we are seeing our borrowers have the option to select pay when they link their IRS data. Now, if you are somebody who say that your job, your income has changed substantially since the last time you filed your tax return, maybe your latest tax return isn't reflective of a job change that you had. Maybe you're making less. Maybe now you've actually stepped away from the job that you had last year and now you're working part-time or you're taking a leave of absence or maybe you're staying home with kids for a bit. Then you would want to use what's called alternative documentation of income. So if you are using alternative documentation of income, i.e. not your tax return, and you select that you would like to not use your tax return, but you'd like to use this alternative documentation of income, so a W-2 or a pay stub or a bank statement, they are not giving borrowers the option to select pay. Instead, what our clients are seeing is that they are told that the servicer will choose a plan for them. And usually it's the plan with the lowest payment, and that plan is going to be 9 times out of 10 or more the safe plan. Not helpful for our folks who want to get on pay and want to get on pay quickly. So if that's you, what we recommend that you do is you fill out a paper application. So you can actually download it. So you can Google IDR payment application PDF, and it should pull up on Google. Download that, fill it out, check the box for the pay plan, take that application that's filled out, and also include your pay stub or whatever your form of documentation of income is, your alternative documentation of income. You take those two pieces of information, those two documents, and you upload them to your servicer portal. Depending on who your servicer is, all of them have a document upload feature. That's where you're going to put that application. You're going to put that in your documents upload folder. And then they will manually put you on the pay plan that way. Like if you are on the studentaid.gov website and they are saying that they're going to pick a plan for you, abort, do not submit, do not pass go. You want to exit out of that and do the manual application. If you're consolidating and you're trying to consolidate before the IDR waiver, just link the IRS tax return. If you also are wanting to get on pay, I don't have a quick and easy workaround for that. If you are consolidating and you're trying to also enroll in an income-driven plan and you're trying to get on pay immediately, that's kind of the only way that I think that you're going to be able to do it. What do you think about that, Ben?
Yeah. So it sounds like if it's giving you trouble online, that paper's the fail-safe way to go, or at least mailing that in and mailing it in certified and having record. You sent it, but ideally being able to do it all online once you've authorized access to tax return. Don't panic when you're doing the paper application for anyone who's got to do it. It'll say in the top right that it expired in January of this year. That is the most up-to-date IDR plan request they have out. That and the PSLF application PDF versions seem to spend about half of a year each pretty frequently being expired, and it always freaks people out. But getting it in before this deadline and having record you sent that in would aid you on the back end if you had any issues beyond that. But no, I think that's everything we needed more people of in terms of pending timelines and some fun changes. It's not just pay going away. Some good stuff moving forward. So take advantage of the IDR waiver if you still need to. Can't believe I missed that one when I was doing my timeline recaps. Definitely make sure you understand if you need to be in pay or ICR before those go away. And the other changes are all pretty positive.
Yeah. One other thing too that I just thought of that I wanted to make mention is that whenever you're changing your income-driven plan, you are required to update your income. So that's another feature of, you know, making this decision. There are so many different factors that you have to weigh when making this decision, which makes it complicated and very frustrating. But do know that another piece of this is if you are switching from save to pay, maybe you were on repay and you've been on repay since the pandemic, and maybe you had a lot lower income the last time you had to certify your income, right? So maybe you used a 2020 tax return, you were on repay, repay got turned into save, and you're paying on this payment that's, I don't know, $16 a month because you were a student at the time, or you maybe you spent half a year traveling and then you got an internship and you've got this really low payment and they're telling you, you don't need to update your income until maybe September of 2025. And so you're going to ride out this $16 a month payment, let's say. If your income has substantially increased since then and you're switching from save to pay, it's going to require you to provide updated income information. And so that's another thing you need to weigh is like, oh my goodness, if I'm going to go from a $16 a month payment to a $1,500 a month payment, ooh, and I'm going to be doing that for 15 months, is that extra expense worth switching to pay and, you know, having that modeled? Should I just stay on save, even if it means I pay for 25 years? If it means that switching to pay is going to increase my payment to $1,500 a month when I've got a $1,600 a month payment for the next 15 months, that's definitely a factor to consider as well. So lots of very critical pieces to the puzzle. We haven't even talked about married filing separate, but your marital status is also a big factor. I guess the key takeaway from this is that like we can't give you one size fits all information. And hopefully this has been helpful in terms of helping you think through the different pieces that you need to consider. But because there are so many different nuances from, you know, borrowing dates to tax filing status to what your tax bomb could be to future income, past income, your IDR certification date, this is a decision that you're going to want to get right. And we can help with that at Student Loan Planner. So you can go to studentloanplanner.com/book. That is where you could get a consultation where we can give you the confidence to know what decision is the right decision for you. Do note that the month of June, because there are so many looming deadlines with pay as you earn going away, ICR going away, IDR waiver expiring, our consultant calendars are going to be booked up really, really quickly. So if there's any question that could save you tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to get this decision right, if you have any hesitation or question about it, just go ahead and go to studentloanplanner.com and just book the consultation just so that you have the peace of mind knowing that you're making the right decision. Anything else you wanted to add to that, Ben?
No, I think we probably, any survivors remaining with us have heads spinning or filled with information. You're right. It's got to be general. We went over a ton of cases for people it may apply to, but beyond booking a consultation, we of course frank out free content like this on our podcasts, on our Instagram, through LinkedIn, through our blogs, and in our Did I Already Say newsletter. Who cares? You probably subscribe, but follow us for those, and definitely be excited to work with anyone to help them figure out these decisions and what needs to be done when through a consultation, or if you're more the one to arm yourself, you listen today, you can use our calculators, you can follow, and we love helping that way too.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, and we wish you all the best. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you, listeners. Thanks, Angie.